about if I just start at the beginning? you could be honest.
Because you know what? They have the sweat equity that went into that memory that they're making with their friends and family. And that's what's important with us, and that's what the I Am Real World's about.
Well, that's a great question. You know, one of the best things about a spring food plot is you get a second chance if it fails.
Chasing Giants with Don Higgins, brought to you by buyafarm.com, your source for farm, recreational properties, rural homes, and more. By tapping into Don's years of experience, dedication, and commitment, Chasing Giants focuses on the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails. Now, here is Don and co-host Terry Peer.
Well, welcome everyone to Chasing Giants, episode 47, brought to you by buyafarm.com. I'm Terry Peer with Don Higgins. Don, it's January 17th. Time's flying by, buddy.
Yeah, it is, Terry. This is the last day of the Illinois hunting season. Yep. For archery, and it's the start of next year.
Scrolling through social media, I've seen a lot of our friends are trying to give it one last effort. They're going out with a bang, trying to get a buck on the ground.
Yeah, well, hopefully they're successful. Yep. But
I know it's snowing
right now. If not, there's always next year.
Yeah, the rain just changed to snow here in Kentucky. I know I got a couple buddies out, so hope that cold weather drives deer out to the food plots and we get a couple bucks on the ground for our friends tonight. So you've been crazy busy the last week, and you're getting ready to head out again next week. Tell us a little bit about your consulting travels real quick.
This week I was in Ohio, did three properties early in the week, and then Thursday, Friday, and Saturday was the Northeast Ohio Sportsman Show, where you and I were at. So did seminars those 3 days, got home late on Saturday night, and tomorrow I've got Steve Shields coming to do some filming for some new YouTube videos. So I know it's been a bit since I put a new YouTube video out. I've just been so stinking busy. But I'm taking a day off from consulting just to film some videos. So be looking for them in the coming weeks. And after Steve leaves, I'm headed to Wisconsin for the rest of the week.
Well, I want to stop and talk a little bit about the Ohio hunting show. I didn't come up at the beginning of it. I came up late. I had to work, but I'm telling you what, it was awesome to see how many people came out to support you being there, the seminars and the podcast. I'll be honest with you, with this COVID thing, it feels like we've been in Groundhog Day for the last year. And getting to just sit and meet new people and talk about deer hunting, I needed that personally as much as anybody.
Yeah, I tell you what, I was shocked at how many people stopped by and mentioned the podcast. Yeah, we knew it was growing and everything, but we was in an area that was predominantly Amish, and I bet at that show it was probably 75% of the people were Amish. And, you know, we made the podcast available to those folks through MTech services, where they could just call in a number and listen to it on the phone. And boy, it caught on, because a lot of them stopped and commented.
Yeah, we almost caused a problem at the show because people were waiting, you know, 20, 30 people deep to talk to you. And we were kind of blocking that whole end of the trade show floor. But we really appreciate everybody coming. There was one cool thing that I really like talking to the Amish. You know, I think, you actually started your seminar off every day with a slide of your top five bucks that now average 204. And your statement to start off that seminar was, "I'm not doing this to brag. I'm clarifying that you can't read a book by its cover, or, you know, you can't make assumptions." And you made the analogy of somebody that was dressed real dirty and rags. You think they might be poor, but they might have more money than anybody. And, you know, being up there in Amish community, we talked about it at breakfast the other day. The thing I respect the most about the Amish and those areas is how self-sustaining they are. There's a business that is run for every single thing that you could need. And it doesn't matter if we're in a war, if we're in a depression, if we're in a pandemic, they just keep plugging away. They don't need help from, I mean, I'm sure they lost some money from the lack of travelers and tourists during Christmas season, but man, they could go around their normal day where it handcuffs most of us. And I really respect that out of them. They're very self-sustaining and sure don't need the federal government helping them for anything.
Well, you know, the Amish have been very supportive of me over the years, and I just got a special place in my heart for the Amish community. They've just been very good to me. But, you know, in my opinion, the Amish community represents what America used to be. Very respectful, very family-oriented. I just, you know, you can't think of a bad word to say about them. They're just a tight-knit community. They help each other out. And it's the way I remember America when I was a kid. And the rest of society's kind of gotten away from that. But those values just continue with the Amish, and I sure admire them for it.
Well, to all of our Amish friends that we got to say hi to at the show that are currently listening on MTech, we really do appreciate you guys. And it was cool to get to listen to how everybody, the story about how they all go about their day. And some of them get to listen to it at work. Some of them, I think you actually had a couple people say that they listened to it as a group at work.
Yeah, there was more than one person that came from out of state just to meet you and I. Because they listened to the podcast. And on Thursday, before you got there, Terry, there was a gentleman, Chad Smith, from Enloe Fork Mine. He drove all the way from Pennsylvania to meet you and I. And he said him and his coworkers just can't wait for the next episode to come out because they all listened to it there at work. So I want to give a shout out to all the guys at Enloe Fork Mine. Your buddy Chad stopped in and put a plug in for you guys. So we appreciate your support.
That's awesome. You know, there was, it was fun. You mentioned how respectful the Amish were, but everybody was just super nice, and coming by, and, you know, everybody just kind of waited their turn and listened to each other telling hunting stories and talking about, you know, listening to questions as people asked. And the trade show hall basically emptied out every time that you did a seminar. You know, I think the other exhibitors probably took their lunch break during your seminar because everybody in the show hall was packed into standing room only for your presentation. It was really cool. Like I said, selfishly, I needed it to just get back on track a little bit more than anything. After this last year, it was really cool just to sit down and talk with people about hunting a little bit.
Yeah, it sure was. And, you know, I don't know how many hunting trade shows anywhere are actually going to take place this year with the COVID deal still happening. But that was one that did take place, and I'm just blessed that I was asked to be there and to speak at that one.
So credit to the promoters and the organizers of that show. Not only was it a great show, to hear the show floor kind of start cheering and hooting and hollering when they were – saying God bless America and all that kind of stuff over the PA system. That was really cool. It's the way it should be. So thanks to everybody who came out. Part of tonight's podcast, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, Don, is because through those conversations we had at the booth or in the seminar, people would ask questions, and I thought they were really good questions. So if it's all right tonight, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, kind of teeing up the dialogue or the conversation or the question that was asked and ask you to expand on it and answer it for all of our listeners to the podcast, because there was even stuff that you said that maybe even I didn't realize. And one of them has to do with the story of Mel. So much of the video of Mel, we could have made that video 2 hours long, but you know, you have to try to compress it. And there was two points that you made in that Mel video that I'd never really talked to you about. One of them was when Mel was 3.5 years old and you and I were in the blind and he came out to feed, you know, when you passed him that time. Mel looked up in the blind and saw one of us moving. And, you know, he kind of just walked away. He was there for a long time. But you mentioned that, you know, just that little bit of something's not right, how it affected Mel. The second one was, I think the second or third time you saw him, he came out of the switchgrass with the nose in his face and went to that scrape, and you had a trail camera that you had put on that tree to get footage of him on that scrape, and you made mention about he saw that trail camera and didn't like it. So in both cases, can you tell the listeners what you were talking about and how Mel reacted? Because I don't think people understand how delicate mature bucks can be with something that you might not bump them, but just a little bit of intrusion makes a difference.
Yeah, you know, we're always talking about lack of human intrusion and discipline on this podcast. And both those play into the story of Mel. So whenever he was 3.5 and you and I were in the 360 blind and we filmed him come out of the real world switchgrass and feed in that deadly dozen plot, you know, he was there in front of us for probably 20 minutes. And there was ample time that we could have got a shot off or whatever. But you and I both had video cameras in our hands, and we was trying to get some good video footage, which we did. But at one point, Mel caught me moving. He had his head down feeding, and I was trying to get in better position to get some better video footage. And he caught that, and he tensed up. And, you know, that's when he started walking away, and I don't remember now if he walked back into the switchgrass or what he did, but
he kind of walked straight down away from us. I was at that point blocked out by the pine tree. I couldn't see a whole lot, but you know, for the listeners to understand, he didn't bolt out of there. His tail didn't go up. He didn't leap and bound. He just tensed up and okay, it's time to go. Something's not right. Right.
Yep. Well, he just stared up at us when he caught that movement for the longest time. He just stood there staring at us. And then he just, you know, walked away. You could tell that any little movement from us was going to send him flying out of there. We just froze, you know, and he snuck away or, you know, just walked away.
One of the disadvantages of the smoky blind is the sun is flat out in our face when the sun goes down. So we have to be really, really careful in that blind as the sun goes down because we're lit up. There's not a lot of shade right there.
Right. But the part of the story that you're referring to, Terry, is that from that point on, Mel left my farm after that. And I quit getting pictures of him. And for 3 weeks, that was actually October 3rd is when this happened. And I did not get another picture of Mel through the end of October. And had no idea where he went until a friend of mine 3 miles away was coming home from work at 3 a.m. and Mel crossed the road in front of him. He seen the eyes, you know, lighten up. There was actually another buck and a doe there as well. He seen their eyes and he slowed way down and Mel was right there in the ditch 10 yards from him. And I had never talked to him about Mel before, but he called me up all excited the next day, and he described Mel to a T. I mean, that year he had forks on both G2s and both G3s and some extra stickers. And he called me up the next day all excited, and he described him perfectly. Forks on both G2s, both G3s, some extra stuff. Said he didn't look like a mature deer, but the other buck with him was mature, but he said Mel's rack was much better.
So this is in October of when Mel was a 3-year-old.
Yep.
We didn't spook him. We didn't jump him. Just a little bit of movement in a blind, and he thought something wasn't right. And what did that do? It pushed him off of that farm for at least 3 weeks, almost 3 miles away.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the 1st of November before I started getting his photo again on the farm. So, and I'm sure it was that little bit of pressure that sent him off because in the past, you know, when he was a 2-year-old, a yearling, he was there throughout October. Yep. And
well, let's talk about the second thing that happened when he was 4.5. You're hunting him the first couple times you go for him and you see him, but walk us through what you were talking about there in the seminar, what you did with this trail camera.
So the 3 out of the first 4 days this season, Steve Shields and I was in a 360 blind, and we had to kind of sit on the sidelines a little bit because of the wind direction. And I knew that Mel was also betting in the switchgrass field, and so he was coming out of the corner of that switchgrass field with the wind straight in his face. And right at the edge of the switchgrass was a field of, or a plot of, real world soybeans that was probably about 20 or 25 yards wide. So he was coming out of the corner of that switchgrass, walking across that soybean plot to a scrape on the other side. And he was doing that with the wind right in his face as he came out. So, and he, like I said, he did it three out of the first four evenings of the season. And, you know, a lot of hunters would have ran in there and hung a stand close by. They would have, you know, before their hunt, they would have showered and sprayed down and had scent elimination clothing and probably took an Ozonix and all that in with them. They would have tried to force the issue and shoot that buck over that scrape. But that would have been a one opportunity proposition. You'd have either got it done the first time or you'd have probably bumped him clear off the property. I decided not to put that pressure on the property, and especially because of what had happened the year before when he left the property for the rest of the month. I just decided to continue hunting stands on the edge where I had the wind advantage, hoping that eventually he would screw up and come by, which is exactly what he did. But when I seen him hit that scrape three out of four evenings, I wanted to get some footage of him on that scrape. We was watching from about 200 yards away, maybe a little more, and right, couldn't get good footage.
Right.
We did it at a distance. So I slipped in one day in the middle of the day, had the wind at my advantage. It was one of those days the wind was really howling, making a lot of noise, you know, in the trees and such. So I thought I could slip in there and hang a trail camera on video mode over that scrape and get his picture as he hit that scrape. And that's exactly what happened within the first couple of days. And in the evening, you know, still daylight, I got him coming and hitting that scrape again. But he locked onto that camera, and you could just tell he was nervous, and he only worked that scrape for about 10 seconds and left. That was the last time he hit that scrape in daylight. Now, I did get him hitting it in the dark a couple of times during the rest of the month. And, you know, it was like a full 3 weeks later before I killed him. So he went from hitting that scrape almost every evening in the daylight to not ever hitting it again in daylight. And it was all because of that trail camera placed over that scrape. With these mature bucks, you just, I mean, I don't think most deer hunters realize how easy it is to bump them. And
well, not only bump them, but something was different over that scrape. He knew it and he didn't come back. So that could have just as much been an existing camera sitting there that you saw him hitting that scrape and you're running down to try to pull the card the next day to see what it was. Every single time that we step foot on our property, it's intrusion. And the reason I wanted you to expand on this, because it wasn't in the video, here is two situations where it really, to be bold, it really almost made it more difficult for you to close the deal on Mel. I mean, both of them could have been catastrophic for you because, you know, he busted one of us in the blind, didn't like it. He leaves for, you know, 3 weeks and is 3 miles away. Somebody could have shot him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, he saw that blind. So every time, and that was what your point you were trying to make to the listeners in the seminar, is every time you set foot on that property, you know, there's a chance, whether or not you bump that deer or not, there's a chance that some negative effect is going to happen with a mature buck. He knows you're there whether you think he knows it or not.
Absolutely. And I just think that's a perfect demonstration of my property has probably less human intrusion on it than just about any property that's managed for hunting. All the activities around the edge, the heart of the property is almost totally free of human intrusion. Yeah. And yet, that buck that lived there, and basically the thing of it is too, he was a 3-year-old when he left the first time,
right,
and a 4-year-old this year. I mean, just think how much harder it is to do with a 5- and 6-year-old buck.
Right. Well, inside of your, I hope people appreciate that. That's a little bit extra nugget on the Mel story that nobody knew about, but I think it really is important to understand. You're walking such a delicate line with these animals when they get mature. The second one that I want to put you on the spot about is one of the listeners in the seminar actually put you on the spot, and you told them, you ask anything you want, I'll answer it. I'm not going to shy away from it. And you laid it out on the line with a question, and it was, what could Ohio do different with their game laws to make it better? And tough question that you didn't shy away with. Why don't you tell our listeners what your answer was?
Well, you know, traveling with all my consulting, I think this state or this winter, I'm going to be in 14 different states consulting. And, you know, so I get the opportunity to see the deer hunting culture in each state. And it varies from state to state. There's no doubt about it. And a lot of it has to do with the game laws in that particular state. And in Ohio, for example, it's just a little bit different than the states around it because of the fact that they can put out bait. You know, they can bait the deer in during hunting season. And so a lot of the properties that I'm on, I see these corn piles, and sometimes it's shelled corn, a lot of times it's ear corn. You know, a deer hunter will take an entire truckload of ear corn and, you know, back up in the woods somewhere and just start shoveling it out. You got a giant pile of corn, and well, if your neighbor does it, that means you got to do it, and on and on and on. It's become, you know, part of the tradition in Ohio. Well, in my opinion, you know, right now I would say Iowa has the best deer hunting herd in the nation, or the deer herd in the nation in terms of quality of the bucks. And a lot of it has to do with the age structure of the Iowa deer herd. They've done a pretty darn good job managing that state's deer herd. However, I think with one regulation change, Ohio could be the best state in the nation. And that one regulation change would be outlawing baiting. Now, I'm a big fan of supplemental feeding, and we got a question about that later in this episode. But oh, the things Ohio has going for it right now is it's got fantastic genetics. I mean, there are some giants that are killed in Ohio every single season. So that's one big positive they have going for them. The other thing is they've got a one-buck limit. So, you know, in Illinois, we got a 2-buck limit. So they're limiting the buck harvest, which is fantastic. And then the other thing that they do really good is that their gun season is in December after the rut. So there's not pressure on those big mature bucks through gun anyway, as they're taking part in the rut. So if you would just get rid of the bait piles in the state of Ohio, because they kill so many yearling and 2-year-old bucks and even 3-year-olds and some older bucks, but it's mainly those young bucks that just get hammered coming into those corn piles. If that one regulation change, I fully believe if they would just get rid of that, in 3 years, Ohio would have the best herd in the nation in terms of producing giant bucks. But you know, as I explained to the crowd at that seminar, I really don't have a dog in that fight. I'm not in Ohio, although I do own a property there. I still consider myself a non-resident because I don't live there. And I'm not going to get on some rampage trying to change the laws in Ohio. That's up to the Ohio hunters, in my opinion. But just as an outsider looking in, if Ohio wanted to have the best deer herd in the nation, all it would take is one regulation change and they'd be there.
Yeah. And this is for our listeners to understand. This is probably one of the biggest fundamental things that Don and I differ on as far as our opinion is hunting over bait. Kentucky is a bait state. I use feed all year long. And to me, I agree with you, but I'll phrase it a little bit differently. I think the problem with bait states is the average hunter doesn't have the discipline not to shoot a young buck over a bait pile. I have no moral or ethical dilemma in shooting a mature target buck with 2 feet standing in a corn pile but I have the discipline not to shoot that young deer. And I think the problem with allowing bait is the majority of people don't have that discipline. They're going to use it. I had this conversation with somebody on social media, private messenger, earlier this week. I actually think that using bait for the in many cases, especially if you're in there a lot, filling the feeder or dumping it on or checking trail cameras, I think it actually can promote nocturnal movement of mature bucks because they can go get that feed anytime they want. But to me, it's where do you draw the line of pouring corn out on the field versus taking a bush hog and bush hogging two rows of corn every other week? I'm not going to get into that. I think people have to make their decision for themselves. But I think it comes down to a lack of discipline in people that say they want to wait and shoot a big buck, but then a 145-inch 10.3-year-old comes out, they put a hole in it.
Well, I think another thing that happens on the bait piles, and, it's not my place to select the make the ethical choices for other hunters. I mean, that's each person's, personal choices, but I think what happens a lot of times on these bait piles is, they see, a hunter, he's got his certain goal, especially in a state with one buck limit. He's not going to shoot a yearling or 2 year old buck, but he's got a one or two of those young bucks coming to a corn pile. And instead of shooting them himself, he'll bring his son or nephew or friend or whatever, and someone else will shoot him as that hunter continues to hunt for a bigger buck. I just think it really increases the harvest of the younger age class bucks.
The same way having a gun season in the rut like Kentucky has. We get into lockdown mode in Kentucky, and the mature bucks all are locked down with a doe. Guess what's out running around being an idiot? It's the younger bucks that end up getting shot with a firearm.
Yeah, and my point really was that there's a lot of states, like I think Illinois has potential. I mean, Illinois at one time was the number one state for giant whitetails, and we screwed it up. I think Illinois could get back and be better than Iowa, but it's going to take more than one regulation change to do it.
Ohio's just one away.
Yep, Ohio is just one regulation change away from being at the top.
Well, as you sit in front of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of guys who put piles of corn out, the looks that came back, but to the same respect, you said I'll give my opinion on it, and I think that's fair. We come from a little bit different opinion in what we believe, but the end result is I think I agree with you as far as I'd rather see him get away from it during the season. Speaking of hunting ethics, it was kind of ironic. I'm going to get off on a little bit of sidetrack and then circle back to the third point I want to make with you.
All right.
A lot of the feedback that we got from people that listened to the podcast is they said, that kind of theme that we're here for the hunting community, not the hunting industry. We're going to say what we believe and not be influenced by, outside pressure of a sponsor or an agenda or anything like that. I think it's okay to say that, we're trying to consider what to do with what trail camera we use next year. And there's actually somebody in the crowd from one of those companies that we might or might not work with. And somebody asked you about using cell cams and what your theory of it is, and you flat laid it out with a potential partner in the stands. And I think that says a lot about where you're coming from as a hunter. It's not going to be swayed by what's going on. And what somebody did is they came and asked you, what do you think of cell cameras? And I want you to talk in 30,000-foot view about hunting ethics in this. And then after you answer that, I want you to dive down more specifically in, I think it's important for people to understand how you use cell cam or how you use trail cameras in general. And that might not also align to cell cameras.
Well, hunting ethics is, to define hunting ethic, it's choices that we make as hunters that limit us beyond what the law limits us. So the law is black and white. This is okay, this is not okay. Well, then each of us as individual hunters, we also need to make some choices. as to what we think is okay. And I want to state right from the beginning that I don't believe for a second it's my place to tell any other hunter what's right and right, what's wrong. And I know somebody's going to immediately throw up the expandable broadhead issue. Well, when it comes to the point of wounding game, losing game, I think we owe it to the animal to give it, to make a clean, ethical kill. So forget about throwing that argument back at me, because when you're talking about an instrument that I believe causes unnecessary wounding and lost animals, that's not ethics. That's just that's the difference between a hunter and a killer, in my opinion. But what I'm talking about is choices we make. For example, my mentor, Alan Foster, I think most people that have followed me have heard me mention his name many times. Alan Foster was, or is, you know, 10 years older than me. He got a hold of me at a pretty young age when we met, and, you know, he instilled some hunting ethics in me. And I remember back when Al was shooting some giant bucks, he refused to use deer sense. And his reasoning for it was he considered it taking undue advantage of a buck. He compared it to a married man that had no intentions of cheating on his wife and having some Playboy model come up to him buck naked and seduce him. And that's how he looked at doe and heat sense. You know, a buck's number one defense is his nose, and using doe and heat scent was taking unfair advantage. Now, Al didn't try to force that belief on me, nor did he ever try to force it on anyone else.
That was his personal opinion.
Exactly. That was his personal opinion and his personal choice that went beyond what hunting laws allowed. And I think as hunters, we each need to make choices like that. And it's not my place, again, to make that choice for any other hunter. But I think the hunting industry has got away from hunting ethics, even talking about hunting ethics. Nobody in the industry does that anymore. It's all about, you know, me, look at me. And we've got more deer killers than we do deer hunters. A deer hunter is a conservationist, first and foremost. He's concerned with the well-being of the herd, as well as the individual animal. And that's where my stance on mechanical broadheads comes in. It's my compassion for the individual animal. I want to see him die quickly and humanely, not be injured and lost. And that's where that stance comes in for me. And if you disagree with me, that's fine. You know, I'm not going to dislike you because you shoot mechanical heads. I got a lot of friends that do. But it's my opinion that we as hunters could do a better job and are offered better equipment to do that. So I don't know if that's answered your question, Terry, or if I've kind of went down a rabbit trail and totally sidetracked. But
well, here's the main theme of it, okay? And this is I'm gonna you talk so much to so many people, you might not even remember exactly how you phrased the answer back. But somebody said, "What do you think about trail cameras?" And you said that you personally struggle a little bit with, you know, is getting cell cameras too far out of the line. And what's happened is the hunting industry is, meaning the companies that create and sell products, that technology keeps evolving and evolving and evolving. Your answer back to the person is, doesn't matter necessarily what I think. This is where I struggle with and where I'm trying to decide where my line is. You were challenging that group of people to not just accept the fact it's legal, I'm going to do it. You need to make the decision that you want to make as far as where that line is for you. That's how you answered this gentleman's question. You can kind of clarify that if you want.
Right. And he, I think, was specifically asking about cell cameras.
Right.
And, you know, that's what I've struggled with. You know, I'm a big proponent of trail cameras, mainly because it just enhances the enjoyment and extends my deer season. My season really starts about July 1st when I get the chance to put those cameras out. You know, the bucks have growed their racks out to the point where you can kind of tell the good ones and how good each buck's going to be. And so my season starts July 1st, the way I look at it, and that's because of trail cameras. And, I understand if you've got a property that's in another state that is several hours from home, those cell cameras, you know, allow you to monitor the herd without, you know, having to drive all that way to check your cards and your cameras. And, you know, just to be fair, I do own one cell camera at this point, and I may buy more. But I just really struggle with the thought that you've got a cameras or multiple cameras out that instantly tell you where a buck's at and gives you the opportunity to instantly react and run out there and try to kill that animal. I think as the hunting industry has matured, hunting ethics have kind of went by the wayside. And like you mentioned, Terry, a big percentage of the new products that are coming out are made to make the kill easier. It's not to enhance the hunt in any way or shape or form. It's just to make the kill easier. And I think at some point, every deer hunter is going to have to make his own choice. Again, it's not for me to make the choice for anyone, but each of us is going to have to decide, you know, what we consider ethical and where we draw our ethical line.
The last thing I will ever do in life is call Don Higgins a politician. but I think, and not saying you answered it like a politician, but I do think that you handled that question with as much grace as possible in explaining the struggle you have personally, but basically challenging everyone in the room to think about that line in the sand that's right for each one of the individuals there and not just trust the game laws, because we've talked about that on this podcast before. This can apply to hunting over bait. This could apply to, using a cell camera. Good grief, it could be the double barrel crossbow. Your challenge to everyone in that room is to not accept the fact that it's legal and it's okay, but where in your heart do you feel that you need to be within? And I think that's going to be different for every person. I was proud to sit back and actually see how you navigated that question, because you you kind of laid it all out on the table with how you feel personally when there's a potential sponsor sitting in the, 12 rows back. I mean, and that didn't affect your answer. So kudos to you. I just think it was awesome to sit there and be part of a great outdoor show and talk deer hunting with people. And I think that, those three questions, we took a little bit longer than I wanted to, would be great talking points on the podcast. So, falls in line directly. Your seminar actually had a longer Q&A time because these listener submitted questions has become so popular. So, I just appreciated it. I know the people that were listening. But before we go to the biofarm.com property of the week, I want to circle back on lessons learned from a research herd. And I know you have a nice little snippet of what you've learned over the last 25 years, not the last 25 years, but owning a captive herd for 25 years. What do you got for us tonight to help us understand these critters a little bit better?
Well, one of the lessons that I learned from that research herd, which I no longer have, I got rid of the last of those animals a few years ago. But during the 25-year period when I did have them, I noticed that specific or individual animals seem to have an annual cycle. So in other words, they would certain events would happen almost on the same day every year or the same time period. For one example was does entering estrus. I noticed that some individual does would come into heat on almost the same day every year. So if I had a doe that was going to come into heat on November 15th, almost every year she was coming into heat on November 15th. And if she missed the 15th, it was only by a day. It would be the 14th or the 16th. And, I never did really fully understand why. My theory is, they come into heat based on the daylight hours. The deer have that pineal gland in their eye that measures the amount of daylight. And, maybe that gland is a little bit different on one deer from another. For example, all humans have a nose, but all our noses don't look alike. They're not the same size. They're not the same shape. That pineal gland on an individual animal or individual white-tailed doe may be a little bit different, and her timing of entering estrus may be off just a little bit because of, you know, that pineal gland. Another thing is buck shedding velvet. When I would have a pen of those captive deer or captive bucks, there were certain individual bucks that were the first ones to shed velvet every year. And some shed early, some shed late. When they were growing their racks, some were early growers, some were late growers. You know, the early growers, by about the 1st of August or early August, their racks were done growing, where other bucks put on a ton of growth in August. And it was always the same bucks every year. Now, when it came to shedding antlers, it wasn't, you know, down to the exact day, but, you know, I would notice certain individual bucks would shed like in last week of January every year. Another individual buck, and maybe the last week of February every year. And I just found it very interesting that the different individual animals, the timing of things like entering estrus or shedding their velvet or shedding their rack was very close for an individual animal every year, year after year. And that led me to write the article that a lot of folks have heard me mention before. The title of the article was Same Time, Same Place, where I detailed how I'd noticed mature bucks in the wild would had the tendency to show up at the same place year after year at the same time. So in other words, if you have a trail camera picture of a mature buck during the first week of October this past year, well, if he's still alive next year, the first week of October, that buck's going to be the same place. And I don't mean like exactly in front of that camera, but I mean that same part of his range. And at that time, that article was published in 2003, and I'd never heard anyone talk about it before that. Now, I know it's a pretty widely accepted almost fact today. That when you get a buck's picture at a certain time, at a certain place, you can just about count on it next year. And it's put a lot of big deer on the ground. But I started noticing that trend way back with my captive research herd, you know, probably 20 years ago or more.
Well, there's something that kind of worked out for the sake of working out that we didn't plan. And that's talking about what happened with the story of Mel, relating it to what you just told us about learning from a captive herd. Because if we're going to rely on annual data, the intrusion has to be none, because we saw what happened with Mel when there was human intrusion in it. So if you're going to rely on this annual data of what can absolutely be a huge advantage to you, we can't booger him. We didn't plan on that tie, but that's pretty cool.
And I'd never even thought about it just now when you brought it up. You're exactly right, Terry. You've got a buck pinned down on an annual pattern. You go in and you blow it. Well, guess what? You just blew that annual pattern. He'll stick to it as long as he's not busted.
That's pretty cool. So.
Yep, for sure.
All right. Well, let's take a little bit of a break and go to the biofarm.com property of the week.
Biofarm.com is your source for farm, recreational properties, rural homes, and more. Now, here is Don Higgins with this week's featured property.
Okay, this week's featured property is a 355-acre farm in Williamson County, Illinois. And I'm telling you what, you need to get on the website and look at this one. It is a very unique property. It is a sportsman's paradise. There's 3.5 miles of river frontage on the Big Muddy River. Of that 355 acres, 83 acres is in cropland. There are two lakes. One is a 6-acre lake, approximately. The other one's approximately 30 acres. The ultimate food plot on the property, 15 acres of alfalfa. You're going to search long and hard to find a better place in southern Illinois for waterfowl, whitetail, and turkey. It's just a fantastic place. And again, you need to see it on the biofarm.com website. the exact location of the property is it's about 4 miles north of Herron, Illinois, 4 miles south of Ziegler, Illinois, and about 4 miles southeast of Royalton, Illinois. If you're interested in this, you can talk to agent Wayne Keller. Wayne's phone number is 618-407-1679. And Wayne would be glad to give you a tour of this place.
I don't think this property is going to last very long. I actually saw this property pop up on my Facebook feed because a couple of the people that I'm friends with and listen to the podcast shared it. And I think Kevin Thayer was one of them, but I saw it in three or four places, and Kevin just said, wow, and shared the property from Buy a Farm's Facebook page. But I agree, this property looks like the real deal.
Yeah, and it's a new listing. So
I don't think this one's going to last very long. All right, very cool. Thanks to the folks at Buy a Farm for their support of the podcast, but most of all, we hope that our listeners will go out on their social media or the website and visit biofarm.com and follow these new listings as they come up. Very, very cool property, but we appreciate their support. So before we move on to the listener-submitted questions, I want to give everybody an update on the hats because our embroidery partner sent me a text while you were doing the previous segment and said that the first batch of hats are going to be shipped out to you to Don this coming week. So here towards the end of the month, we'll start shipping those out to the people who've pre-ordered. But Don, you and I are going to have to talk after the podcast because we've already even been beyond what we've sold more than what we thought we would. So we're going to have to make a decision about what to do here, whether to leave it open or cut these hat orders off. And wait till we decide what to do for apparel. So if you're going to order a Chasing Giants hat, I got my first one this weekend. Please go to Higgins Outdoors website and get those pre-orders in so we can figure out how to manage this thing for you guys. We're not in the apparel business, but we're just trying to do it for you all. So we're not making any money. So go check those out. Don, I guess we'll have to figure that out as we go. So.
I was a bit surprised how many orders we got.
Yeah, so we're already over what we anticipated. So the good news is the people that have ordered, I know a lot of people ordered your book and a t-shirt, so we'll be able to get the whole box of things that they ordered out to them here in the next couple of weeks. So you'll be receiving the first shipment of hats late this week. So we can start working on that. So let's move on to our questions from our listeners for tonight.
Okay, the first question comes from Ryan Kimmler of Wentzville, Missouri. He says, Don and Terry, I love the podcast. I've been learning a lot. Keep up the great work. Well, too late, Ryan.
Oh, no. Should we skip the question then?
Maybe we should.
We better skip the question. For the reason we're laughing is I just looked down at my paper, and we kind of read as we go, and the first thing that is in the second sentence is, please leave my name anonymous. So out of respect for Ryan, let's not read that question, and maybe we'll come back to it one future episode here. But apologize about that, Ryan.
I guess I should have read it before I did pre-read it before the show, but I forgot that I wasn't supposed to mention his name.
We get in a groove and kind of go through our outline. Apologize about that, Ryan, but we'll out of respect for you, we won't read that question for right now. So let's skip to our second listener submitted question for the night.
The next one comes from Brian Fryer of LaPorte, Indiana. Brian says, hi, Don. I am a relatively new listener to your podcast. I have reviewed most of your past episodes and don't find any information about this topic. My questions are, what is your opinion about supplemental feeding? Do you practice this on your farms? And if you do, what is your recommendation about type of feed as well as the duration of feeding? Thanks for all the information you have provided. Looking forward to hearing from you about this subject. Thank you and God bless. Regards, Brian. Well, Brian, I've got two properties, as you know, or you probably know, one in Illinois, one in Ohio. My Illinois farm, I'm not allowed by law to do any supplemental feeding, so I don't. In Ohio, it's a different story. And one of the reasons I bought property in Ohio was because they do allow supplemental feeding. I'm a big fan of it. Now, supplemental feeding is totally different than baiting. Just want to make that clarification, because if you was listening to this podcast earlier, we talked about Ohio and the practice of corn piles. I don't consider that supplemental feeding. I consider that baiting. Supplemental feeding, you asked about the type of the feed as well as the duration of feeding. Well, I want the highest quality feed possible, something like Real World's Maximizer Complete Feed that has every nutrient in it that a deer could need, and it's in balanced ratios. So I don't want to just be feeding them corn just to give them something to eat. I want to give them the most nutrient-dense food that I can to help their health and their production of fawns and antler. Duration of feeding, you know, in Ohio, I've got three feeders on that farm and try to keep feeding them at all times. Now, there's periods of the year where they're going to eat a lot more. For example, in the winter months, like right now, they're going to go through a whole lot more feed than they do in the summertime. So keep that feed year-round. Give them a high quality feed, and I am a big fan of supplemental feeding.
Spot on. The big thing is, you know, we go back, and Brian, I know you said you've gone back and listened to it, but one of the things I want to throw out there is you go back and listen to like the episode with Dr. Strickland, and Don has talked about it several times, is this whole thing about fetal programming. And, you know, when you're talking about humans, cattle, deer, the first, and a human, it's the trimester. I don't know if it's still called that. I guess it's not in the, in a deer, is some of the most pivotal time. And just putting mineral out this time of year, even though it's good, they don't consume as much of it as we want them to, because one of the ways you can get the intake of valuable minerals and feed supplement is through feed itself. So that's what Don is saying about the corn. It's not even corn and protein and fat, but it's also if we use like something like our complete feed, we're getting that same nutrients inside of that dough, where she might not go and consume as much at the mineral lick, but she's getting that in her system through feed. That's really, really important.
Yep, for sure. When you get into serious land management and you're considering things like the fetal programming and such, it's really important that you get those does the best nutrition possible, and then you practice shooting the does that have those buck fawns with them. Just supplemental feed helps take your nutrition level. And, you know, when it comes to growing them big antlers, you know, we're looking at three things: age, nutrition, and genetics. Nutrition is one that we have some control over. So, you know, I'm a big fan of that supplemental feeding and doing what we can.
Very good.
Next question comes from David Least from Antioch, Illinois. David says, "Hey, Don and Terry, first want to say how much I enjoy the podcast. I have a little bit of a different question. It's one I've been struggling with for a while. I wonder how you and Terry justify in your minds participating in today's world of social media. I'm speaking mainly of Facebook and YouTube. I enjoy lots of content on both platforms, including yours. I also belong to many groups on Facebook. But lately, I'm finding it more difficult to participate with both of these companies that I know dislike me and almost everything I believe in, whether it's politics, religion, hunting, or the Second Amendment. I also feel like these companies, along with many others, had their thumbs on the scale affecting the outcome of our most recent election. This in no way is me calling you guys out for utilizing these formats, but trying to get your opinion on how you deal with this. Like most things in life, there's good and bad in everything, internet included. Unfortunately, these platforms are the only places now where this content is available. Thanks for your time reading this. Hoping all have a prosperous 2021. Sincerely, David Least." Oh, good question, David. I've actually considered, I've spent a lot of time dwelling on your topic. social media, and basically the people behind it who are essentially are against everything that I support, you know, just like you described. Personally, social media for me is a way to drive my business. That is my main reason that I ever got on social media to start with, and it's the main thing that keeps me on there today. Now, if you follow me at all, you know occasionally I get on a political rant where I may share a dozen different political posts in a week. But for the main part, social media to me is advertising for my business, and it's essentially free advertising. I just hate supporting these companies, just like you mentioned. But at the present time, there's not really much of an alternative. If you know, we were to walk away from Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, whatever, what's that leave us? Are we going to go back to paid advertising in hunting magazines, which is a slowly dying thing? I just don't see a better option at the moment. And I'm guessing that Terry, I've kind of teed him up with this question because I think he has a unique perspective with the marketing aspect that he has. So, Terry, take it away.
It's a heavy question, no doubt. I think anyone that comes from the conservative side of the spectrum feels the threat right now with basically analytics or some keyword search engine following every single thing that we post and potentially, you know, restricting that from being seen. I think it's just a clear sign that Satan can use anything he can to get the grasp on people that try to do something good. There's a lot of good things that are on social media. There's a lot of bad. And right now, I think this almost ties back a little bit to the ethics that we were talking about in the hunting industry. I think there's some of that that'll apply here. I think each person has to decide, you know, what's the most important thing to them. And if social media causes you to stumble and it's something that you can't manage or handle, I think it is the right decision to get away from it. If I'm on a diet and I have very little willpower to eat Twinkies, the last thing I want to do is have Twinkies in my cupboard. If I'm an alcoholic, I don't want to go sit at a bar and eat chicken wings and watch a football game. If I think that it's something that you struggle with and you think is wrong, most of the time, if you have to talk yourself into something, it's a bad decision to begin with. So I hear you. For me personally, I continue to use social media to help make a difference in other people's lives. And if I can take these liberal companies' platforms and do something good with them, I'm going to continue to do it until they shut me down. When they stop letting me try to do something good or stop making a difference in kids' lives, stop, helping support past players. For instance, I had a former softball player that just got shipped out to basic training in the Air Force. And for me to support her and tell her I'm praying for her and keep up with her, if I can use social media to do that, to let her know people at home still love her and are supporting her, absolutely, I'm going to stay on it, aside from the business aspect of it. The thing that I'm most ashamed of is that no one in this country has came up with these platforms or some way to do the same thing from the conservative side and found a way to do that. And all I can say is shame on us for not someone figuring that out. But I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I think each individual is going to have to draw the line. You know, if you say I'm not going to use Facebook or YouTube, are you going to get rid of your iPhone? Because it's still the same liberal-minded people that run those companies too, that are doing the exact same things. They're all in coercion with each other. So unfortunately, it's going to get worse before it gets better. As long as I'm able to be supportive, share scripture, be there for my local community and players and try to make a difference in somebody's life, I'm going to still try to use these liberal companies for something good. I guess that's my only way to answer it.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope for sure. And, you know, if we can use them for free advertising for our companies, you know, what do we do with the money that we make? I mean, we're supporting good causes. And if we can use these liberal platforms to make a profit and then use that profit for good, you know, we're kind of, you know, using their weapon against them in a sense. So, you know, you can spin it just about every way you want to. And I certainly support, I've got friends that just this week have informed me that they're no longer on social media. Two of them I can think of instantly are Patrick Simpson and Steve Shields, who does my YouTube videos. Both those guys removed themselves from social media this week, and I applaud them for that. You know, having an opinion is one thing, but, you know, having the guts to back up your opinion and do something about it is something that a lot of people don't have. So that for those of you listening to this that have given up social media, my hat's off to you. I'd be doing the same thing if it wasn't for the business side of things. So we can spin it 100 different ways, but I certainly understand and appreciate the position you're coming from.
You know, one of the reasons I didn't want to do this podcast when you called me and asked me to do it is when you put yourself out there, there's always going to be people that try to tear you down, no matter what it is. And the thing that I didn't want to necessarily be part of is be on something to talk deer hunting and have the haters come after me. And I know we've gotten emails from some of our listeners that say, don't worry about what they say, quit focusing on it. And it's easy to sit back and say that, but when somebody's attacking you for trying to do something good, it's hard not to respond. And, you know, social media is something that gives a lot of people keyboard courage, where they can come up and be very hateful instead of trying to make a difference in somebody's life. And even as early as this last week, Don doesn't even know this, I didn't tell him about it, but there was a gentleman in Georgia that flat out called me and Don by name in a video questioning our faith, questioning what we were doing in the outdoor industry for the sake of making money. And it was really, really hard not to respond. And, you know, you can say you don't agree with somebody, but it's just the hate where people have taken sides and they just want to fight anymore. It gets really tough to deal with. And it's a delicate line of whether we call them out or we just let it go. You know, you don't know whether if I say something and put them in their place, does that make it stop or does that make it worse? And I just get reminded real quick before we close out tonight of Matthew chapter 5, verse 11. It says, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So all I got to say is those people that are struggling with the social media thing and what to do or not, whether you decide to keep it or let it go, that's your decision. But don't stop trying to do good. Don't stop trying to stand up for your faith, your values, the outdoor industry, the Second Amendment, and what you stand for. Stand firm in that. And if they shut you down, they shut you down, because the Bible promises us the reward in heaven. It's part of the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5. So I just encourage you, whatever you decide to do, don't let it threaten you for what you feel is your stance. And if you decide to separate yourself from it, I respect you just as much as if you share scripture on your page every day.
Amen. So, well said, Terry.
But it's still crazy humbling, Don, that this many people are enjoying the podcast and what we're about. It's an honor to be part of it. It's an honor to say that we're here for the listeners of this podcast and the hunting community, not the hunting industry. And that's coming from two guys that work for an outdoor company. it's a different perspective. So from the bottom of my heart, guys, you know, we hope that you enjoy where we're coming from. I think that's why we're a little bit different in this thing, and I think it's just going to continue to grow. So before Don takes you out, just know that it's really weird for people to come up and want to take their picture with me. I understand you guys wanting to meet Don, but I'm just here along for the ride and appreciate the kind words that everybody's sent. It means a lot.
Yeah, the support has been overwhelming, and neither Terry nor I were ever set out to be heroes. We've said it many times. We're just simple country boys chasing our dreams, walking through the doors that God has opened for us. And you guys supporting us make it possible. If you've got ideas to help us make this podcast better, by all means, send them our way. And we'll certainly have a look at them. So, Terry, if you've got no further words.
No. Thanks, everybody. We'll keep trying to bring you content to make you a better hunter. That's what it's all about. Thanks, everybody.
We want to thank our sponsors, BuyAFarm.com, 360 Hunting Blinds, Quiet Cat, Real World Wildlife Products, Vortex Optics, Lone Wolf Tree Stands, and Matthews Archery. Have a great week, everyone.